The way doctors are trained has changed over the past few decades. The business of medicine has changed too. Rarely do doctors have their own private practices. Most are part of larger groups now, and there's a shortage of primary care physicians that just keeps growing. We're going to talk about these changes today. We'd like to hear from you too. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Joining me are Chair and Fred Lazarus, Jr. Endowed Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Philip Diller, Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Chair of the Department of Medical Education at UC's College of Medicine, Dr. Andrew Filak, and joining us on the phone, Dean at the Wright State Boonshoft School of Medicine, Dr. Marjorie Bowman. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Bowman, good afternoon.
Hello.
Glad to have you with us today. I'd like to start out talking just about the whole process of how doctors and medical students are trained. And Dr. Filak, maybe we'll start with you. Once a person graduates with their bachelor's degree in 4 years of college, they enter medical school. Along with classes, what kind of training do they get?
Okay, medical school has changed over the past several decades. When I was in medical school, we had a traditional curriculum that was 2 years of basic sciences and then 2 years of clinical training. We have now created much more of a blended model with earlier clinical experiences, and we've shifted from a discipline-based to more of a model based on the organ system approach, an integrated approach.
Well, so, I'm not sure what that means. What's discipline-based? What does that
Discipline-based would be a course like physiology or pharmacology taught as an independent, separate course. And now what we're doing is we will take a subject like cardiovascular diseases, and we will teach all the disciplines related to cardiovascular diseases in a block. So it's integrated for the student. It's a different approach to the to learning along those ways.
So they'll get some biochemistry, they'll get some pathology, the diseases related, say, to the heart. They'll get some physiology, you know, how the organs actually interact with each other and work together in that sense. So it's a different way. Those courses used to be separate, but now it's all integrated into the system organ block. So a little different approach.
Dr. Bowman, is that true at Wright State also?
In many ways, yes. We have done much more incorporation of an integration across the years, such as integrating more basic sciences into things like clinical rotations. We also are integrating more of the behavioral and social sciences along the way, and also definitely doing much more active learning, in our case frequently through team-based learning, which we call TBL for short. And ways to get the students much more involved in their actual learning process and learning more than one thing at once, not only the topic area, such as the cardiovascular diseases, but also how to interact with others, learn to work with others, teamwork, peer evaluation, personal evaluation, et cetera.
Dr. Bowman brings up a very interesting component, I think, in a shift in medical education, which is that early clinical experience. And so at her school, along with ours, right in the first year, students are exposed to patients, either through standardized patients or to live patients, both in the clinical setting and in the setting for evaluation.
I'm going to interrupt you again.
Sure.
I would assume all patients are live. What's the difference between a standardized versus a live patient?
Thanks for the clarification. What we do is standardized patients are actors that are trained to simulate the patient experience. And they are very, very good at both teaching, but they're also very, very good at providing feedback to the students. So a scenario would be we would develop a case. We would train 15 individuals to have the symptoms of that case. The student could go in that controlled setting, take a history, do a physical exam on that patient to get feedback. It's a less threatening situation for the student. It's a practice experience and a learning experience, and it provides the student with more comfort before they go out and they really start dealing with their live patients.
Do the students know they are actors?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not like they're concerned that they have to treat them. It sounds like a whole career out there for folks that want to get it.
Well, in fact, some people do make their living as standardized or simulated patients. I would say, though, in general, that simulation is much more part of medical education than it used to be. Simulation, training to work in teams, interprofessional education. But simulation is not just simulated patients that are live patients. We also have a lot more models and computer simulations and things like that that help to simulate the environment before one practices or does things to real patients. You're doing it on a fake arm and putting in an IV intravenous line or something like that.
We used to have a saying in medicine, see one, do one, teach one, where you would literally see somebody do a procedure, then you would do one, and then you would teach someone else. And that was on patients. We didn't have...
Really, just that few times?
It could be.
Yes.
Not often, but it could happen like that. And now it is much more controlled, where, as Dr. Bowman was stating, is, for example, the simple act of drawing blood. We now have very lifelike simulated models that we can do so the students can practice on there before they ever have to do it on a live patient. And so they get the experience of doing it. It's better for the patient. It's better for the student. It's a technology that just simply didn't exist back when
we
I was
actually
a medical
have
student.
Ones that also actually bleed if you're getting them wrong.
Okay, this is making me hurt just thinking about it. Dr. Teller?
So in the past, we would do it on each other. That's how we learned.
Really?
Yeah. So we were often our own guinea pigs, if you will, getting trained for blood drawing and some of the things. So.
But some people are much happier to enter medical school not having to know they'll also be the be the test case as well. But you do have simulators that really can do this then. So you have, it's more than just the bones. Do you still use cadavers? I mean, there was certainly, my cousin graduated from Wright State a number of years ago, and she talked a lot about the cadaver. Does that still happen?
Yes, we definitely have a large cadaver program, and it is part of the training program, not just for our medical students, but also for our nursing students, for emergency medical technicians, and a whole variety of people who need that kind of exposure. A lot of that exposure is around really learning anatomy and the interplay of the different parts of the body in one area or another. So it's not just about how to simulate patient care. It's really about helping. The more you see things real, in addition to book learning, the better you understand it.
Talk about your own training. How do you feel this differs? I assume, obviously, you must think it's better. You would not be supporting it. But how different do you think it is? How are the students that come out now different than your experiences were when you were trained?
I think... The students coming out now, because of the integrated model, I mean, there's a couple of things that are starting to appear. As we're getting earlier clinical experiences for students, I think one of the things that is now starting to occur earlier for them is that interaction with the patient. Initially, there's a lot of anxiety, and as you're interacting with live people, real patients, as opposed to, say, a simulated patient, as you're getting that earlier in your experience, we're finding that students are much more comfortable in gathering the information that they need to rather than being so self-conscious about, you know, what am I doing? Am I doing this right? Their focus is really on the patient earlier, and they're in a sense, demystifying that experience of talking to a person about some very personal things. That's clearly happening with the curriculum changes that we've seen. Students are much, much more comfortable with that. As one example of, I think, one of the enhancements or benefits of this newer approach to teaching students.
Yeah, to follow up on what Phil was just talking about, I think the approach to medical education, we're trying to make it more humanistic, both for the student and for the patient, and focusing much more on what previously been called some of the soft parts of medicine. The science part is the one part, but it's the interpersonal skills that we focus much more. How do you interact? And that starts actually even with the admissions process now, where schools are really looking at a much more holistic admissions process. There are a lot of people who have the basic knowledge that they can succeed in medical school, but do they have the interpersonal skills that are essential to being a good physician also? And the educational process really then looking at the patient-centered approach, that it all starts with the patient and ends with the patient, focusing on the patient, not on the textbook, not on the models, but actually on the patient.
Dr. Phillip, do you find that the students that have the opportunity to really learn more and do better with his interpersonal skills actually can become better doctors and that they get more information from the patients to help make better diagnoses?
Well, it goes back to the basic premise that I have, is that where I get the most information is not from lab tests or not from x-rays, but from the patient. If you can't take a good history, then you're not going to be able to really treat the patient. You're not going to be able to fully understand what's going on with them. So I think the interpersonal skills are of the utmost importance in taking care of patients.
Our phone number is 513. Just one second, Dr. Bowman. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. You can email questions to us, talk@wvxu.org, post them on our Facebook page, or send us a tweet. Dr. Bowman?
I was going to say that we used to say that 90% of diagnosis is from talking to the patient, and there's still great truth to that. I would also add that in terms of some of the changes and how it helps, I think that our students are evaluated in more different types of ways than in the past, which was primarily examination, shall we say. Now we get far more individualized feedback, more in team settings. There's much more emphasis on professionalism and understanding what professionalism. All of those things, I think, do make for better doctors. I think that there are people who graduated from medical school in the past who today we wound up just over professionalism issues, not just whether or not they know enough. I think that that leads into or feeds into the fact that more and more we're looking at metrics of outcomes, quality measures. How do you get measured on the outcome of the patient? And if you're looking for outcomes of patients, the doctors who know how best to work with their patients and help the patients to make their needed changes or take their medicine as they need to are the doctors who will have the best outcomes.
Dr. Diller, you agree?
Very much so. It's definitely we've seen that happen, and it's as well that particularly around the outcomes, I think that's been a shift, big shift in focus in medicine in the last two decades. Clearly, having metrics to evaluate how we're doing is just part and parcel of the discussions we have both in medical school and now out in clinical practice. Students get to see that.
We're talking today about how medical students are trained and the growing need for more doctors. We'll continue our discussion and take your questions and comments in just a moment. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Especially interested in hearing not only from patients, but from doctors as well. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about how medical students are trained and the growing need for more doctors. My guests are Chair and Fred Lazarus Jr. Endowed Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Philip Diller, Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Chair, Department of Medical Education at UC's College of Medicine, Dr. Andrew Filak, and joining us on the phone, the Dean at the Wright State Boonshoft School of Medicine, Dr. Marjorie Bowman. Again, you can join the discussion. We'd like to hear from you at 513-419-7100. Email us at talk@wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We've talked a lot about those first year or a couple of years in medical school. Medical school is 4 years long, and eventually you're really not in the classroom so much as you are in the hospitals. Can Dr. Filak, maybe you can start out explaining for us what an intern is, what a resident is, and what they do.
Sure. After the 4 years of medical school, although an individual has a Doctor of Medicine degree, they really can't do anything yet. They need to go on to postgraduate education, graduate medical education is what we call it, and the terms that are used are internship, residency, and fellowship programs. The internship is commonly referred to as the first year after medical school, although it's also sometimes called a first-year resident. Residency programs, depending on the specialty, are anywhere from 3 to 7 years. In family medicine, general internal medicine, they're 3 years. Neurosurgery is up to 7 years of training. For people who then want to subspecialize, so for example, a cardiologist will have done 3 years of internal medicine, and then they do a cardiology fellowship program of 3 years in order to become certified in cardiology.
And what one of the things that we all hear about or have heard about over the years is how the interns, the residents, are just overworked. They're working 24 hours straight, 48 hours straight. They sleep at the hospital for an hour here or there. There's fear of mistakes because they're so sleep deprived. And there was so much concern about that 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 seems to have changed. Dr. Bowman, can you explain how that works? Do you still work them constantly?
Well, certainly residency is still a lot of work. That part hasn't changed, but the actual number of hours and how those hours are done during a week has become much more tightly controlled by the body that accredits graduate medical education, and that is the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. So they have set a number of hours a week that is the maximum, which still scares a lot of people, and that's called 80 hours a week. Residents don't actually average that amount, but it is still more than the average full-time job when you are a resident. So the emphasis has been on how to make sure that they both can recognize when they're becoming sleep deprived and things aren't going right, and they can always ask for someone else to take over that care, and to also provide more opportunities for sleep. So, for example, the first-year residents can't be on in the hospital working all day and then stay all night too.
Could they before? I mean, what was it?
A thing of the past.
What was it like before? I mean, what you say 80 hours a week now, was it 120 before?
Well, it could be, and for certain fields was more likely to be. And for example, in the surgical fields, a lot of the emphasis is on how do I get the cases and get the experience I need so I'm a good surgeon when I get out. So there's been a lot of pressure, not just from faculty, but also residents, to be at the hospital as much as they can to be able to be involved with different kinds of cases. And that has led to some of the long hours.
Dr. Diller, you?
I was just going to say, when I was in medical school and on the surgery rotation, those residents were on every other night, meaning that they were in the hospital every other night, and that was for 5 years. And so,
and they worked during the day also?
Worked during the day, worked all through the night. So they could work a 36-hour shift, go home, and then come back and start another 36-hour shift. Those days are gone. We now have limits. 16 hours for an intern is the maximum amount of time that they can actually work in the hospital. So that's changed dramatically, you know, going from that. And the focus was on patient safety. That was one of the big drivers as to why the duty hours limits were put in, was to make sure that we had people who are not taking care of people who are sleep deprived, and that there was adequate supervision to be able to make sure that patients were well taken care of. And so those are the primary reasons why there's been this big move to limit the training hours for people.
Now, some say, and there have been some studies that show that the doctors are not coming out as well trained since they don't spend as much time. Is it half of one, six dozen of the other? I mean,
I think that is correct. I think the issue is how much is it, and are there fields that need to extend programs length, or do we just need to figure out how to get the training that they have maximum efficiency? So how do we get them a lot of the same kind of experience in terms of cases and case volume, for example, that they would have had in the old way of doing it to in the new hour limitations? But there is some literature that it has hurt resident experience, and we need to find ways around that.
No, that's true. I mean, the learning that goes on for each one of us is in direct contact with patients. And so the volume that you have during your training years are clearly more, those who have more volume and get to see more, do more, actually are that much farther along. If you believe in the 10,000-hour rule, as we often do, I often think it's 10,000 hours of patient care, that you actual contact time that you have to have. And in our specialty in family medicine, when you total up how many hours of actual patient contact you have, medical school residency, and it doesn't, 10,000 hours generally isn't hit until you're actually out in practice third or fourth year.
Really?
Yes.
I would also note that the electronic medical record has both and helped and hindered us on this, in that the amount of time now spent on maybe even quality improvement or measuring those quality outcomes, and the amount of time spent on charting has increased also simultaneously with the reduction in the number of hours available.
What are you saying here? What are you saying, that because there's so much time spent on entering all this information into the medical electronic medical files, that they're not spending that time with the patients?
That's correct. They have less time with the patients than used to be true.
What do you think in terms of, Dr. Felick, maybe you can talk about the electronic medical records. Do they have benefits as well?
Oh, I think as Dr. Bowman started to indicate, is it's a double-edged sword. There are certainly significant benefits from an electronic record. Is if I see a patient and Dr. Diller sees the patient the following day, as long as the information is in there, much more readily accessible. If we use the tools correctly, you can aggregate data. You can start doing population-based medicine, looking at all the diabetics in your practice and doing things like that. That is very, very difficult to do with handwritten charts. However, it takes time to input the data. And it's that GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't put the information in, and that's a very time-consuming process. The medical records are not always as intuitive as we would like them to be, and there's a lot of data to be entered.
The doctors do that themselves? I know a lot of times when I go to an appointment, you'll have a nurse or an assistant that'll come in and take an awful lot of that information and enter it. The doctor still seems to enter some. How much is the doctor responsible for?
It depends on the practice. There are some practices, there are some physicians in some specialties that will hire a scribe to do it, have them in the exam room with the patient doing the work. A primary care practice can't afford to do that. It's how you leverage your nursing staff. As Dr. Bowman and Dr. Diller pointed, it's a team-based approach to patient care. So your medical assistant, your nurse, input some of the data that you review. But then the data that you're soliciting on the history that the nurse can't get, that only you can get, the physical examination, your thoughts as far as the assessment and plan, you need to put that information into the computer. You can't rely on someone else to do that.
In addition, the physician is still responsible. And so if you ask about responsibility, it is the physician's responsibility. I think also, though, the expectation of how much we enter into charts has changed. I do remember visiting small-town family practices in Western North Carolina where 10 years of notes were on a note card, sore throat, blood pressure, and one note from an average office visit could easily encompass 3 pages now.
I do want to point out we got a question from Sharon that's on Facebook, who was concerned that we're only talking about physicians today and not nurse practitioners, certified nurses, midwives, physicians assistants, etc. And we do want to do that in another show. We just think that's a much broader topic than we can handle in 1 hour. So we are just focusing on doctors today, but we will get to those other topics on shows in the future here on WVXU Cincinnati Edition. Our phone number, if you have a question, 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're on Facebook and on Twitter. I want to change gears a little bit here to not only talk about the whole idea of how you train medical students to be doctors, but the whole business of medicine has changed greatly over the past couple of decades. You've gone from a single doctor in private practice to a group of doctors to now a group of doctors that's run by a hospital. How has all of this merging and buyouts and all those sorts of things affected the profession of medicine?
I think one of the ways is just the amount of control and autonomy that the physicians have, you know, in terms of directing their practice and styles of practice. I think one of the things that we know that there is a lot of variation in medicine and that there's a focus around trying to improve outcomes and processes. And we know that if we can improve processes and have standardized approaches, we can reduce the variability. And many of the systems are trying to move in that direction to create system processes that actually enhance and improve patient care. The trade-off is that physicians don't have as much of control and autonomy, maybe to practice in the way that they would think so. And so there's a lot more dialogue and discussion at the system level for the physicians to try to shape those kind of practice style. And so that's one of the things that I think the system versus having more of an independent, smaller practice has changed.
I think from the business sense also is a private practice was basically a small business. And physicians tend to be pretty bright people, but they may not always be the best business person. Now, with the complexities of medicine, to try to run the business aspects of a practice, hiring, firing, billing, coding, all the different things that are going on, there's inefficiencies trying to do it on your own, that if you're part of a bigger system that's doing the back office functions, can really help maybe to free up the doctor to do more of the doctoring time, patient care time. So I think there can be some advantages to that. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we see docs joining bigger systems like that.
I think another help that's with joining systems now are just the purchasing of the EMR, the electronic health records. You know, some of those are very cost prohibitive in many smaller practices. It's a little harder for them maybe to have the resources to buy that. But the larger systems have those resources and realize that's the future infrastructure, current infrastructure for practicing medicine. And so there's some real benefits with that as well, of having be part of a larger system that has a record that can talk across the system.
And the economics of healthcare have changed. I mean, reimbursement is going down. There are increasing threats to reimbursement. So physicians are trying to look at ways that they can be as financially viable as possible.
Dr. Bowman, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking about the implications for as we become these larger health systems. There's rumor that there will only be a few in the country within a few years, and that there's much more conglomeration. In some ways, it can mean more mobility for physicians because they're not tied down to a private practice that they've invested large sums of their individual dollars in. I think, though, that the trend tends to mean that there are a lot more people involved in an individual's care. And so this attempt to make for uniformity and to break it down to its lowest common denominator may mean that in a hospital visit, a hospital day, you may meet 20 people who come in your room. And in an office visit, you may interact with 8 people on a not uncommon basis. I think that that challenges people's ability to learn and understand the whole patient and to get a real sense of the person. So some of the question is, how much will that mean depersonalization of medicine and less emphasis on the direct doctor-patient relationship, which I perceive as valuable towards patients' outcomes as well?
Dr. Phillips?
I agree. I think that, you know, we want to try to keep the focus on the patient throughout all of this. And I worry, like Dr. Bowman does, about the threats to the doctor-patient relationship. That the business becomes the most important thing, productivity becomes, you know, more important. How do you find the time to spend with the patient to find out what is really going on with them? Sometimes a sore throat is just a sore throat, but sometimes a sore throat is an entree into the system because there's major issues going on, either in the family, other illnesses going on. If you just have 5 minutes,
or,
10 minutes.
Or an acute leukemia. Right. You know, I've had a sore throat come in and, you know, it was an acute leukemia. So they're not always what they seem to be on the surface. And sometimes I think these checklists and, oh, I'm asking you this list of questions, and the patient says, well, I wouldn't describe it that way. And, well, there's no room in the chart for that. I'm doing a checklist. And so they miss some of the important aspects, potentially, of the history, which are the subtleties behind it.
Well, and with a group, it's not uncommon if you certainly on a quick call, I don't feel well, I need to get in a hurry basis, you're not always going to be seeing the same doctor. Is there some concern that by seeing different doctors, the first patients maybe aren't as comfortable as they are seeing the same person every time? Or that if the same person sees them, they'll be more aware of a slight change, whereas if different doctors are seeing that patient, it won't work the same way?
I think the latter is actually true. Is that, I'm sorry, the continuity of practice is a foundation. Now, you're talking to 3 family physicians, so we honestly believe in that, but the continuity really makes a big difference. Is you can get a sense of, is this a patient who doesn't usually complain because you've seen them many times before, who now is complaining about something? And is that real? Versus someone who tends to be a little bit more of the kind who brings every little issue to your attention. How do you sort those out on a visit where you really don't know the patient at all? So I think getting to know your patients over time is extremely helpful.
Right, and we can. There is data that supports that. You can also sometimes be trapped by seeing somebody all the time, but you can easily see, and I'm sure all 3 of us could have examples of times that residents or other doctors see the patient and think one thing, and you walk in the room and you say, "Oh no, this guy's sick this time. That's not how he usually looks," or some other version of that because you know them, or you may happen to know that one time they mentioned that their grandmother had blank, and those things become important. You can also pick up a history much faster when you already know them. Trying to look through an electronic medical record and truly getting all of their history can take a long time. And if I've seen and known the patient for a while, sometimes I have most of that just in my head, and I don't have to refresh it every time I'm walking into a new room.
How many patients, Dr. Diller, can a doctor handle, though, to try to remember that? I know just in having guests here in the studio each week, it, you know, somebody will say, hey, I was on your show a year and a half or 2 years ago, and I can look right at them and think, wow, I should remember that, but I don't. You don't see people sometimes except maybe once a year or even less in some instances.
No, it's really interesting. I think there are some physicians from previous generations who had very large practices. My dad, 6,000 patients active.
And, oh, my goodness.
And he could recall, you know, who they were. And the reason that happened, there's a couple reasons. One is that if you see a person, I think it's around four times where you've had recurrence of interactions, certainly within a 2 year period, 18 month period, four times, you really get to begin to know the patient's story and some of the unique aspects of that person. And then multiply that over a decade and you're seeing them on a routine basis. There's a lot of collective knowledge. One of the things that also happens is that, in a sense, you're training your memory every time you see that person, and your memory actually expands. And it's really remarkable, I think, as you're in practice for a length of time, you can recall stories. I'm sure Andy could just start 25, 30 years ago of people that he took care of and could tell you very specific instances.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. We have Herve on the phone from Cincinnati. Hi, Herve. What's your question?
Well, no, it's a comment, and that is that the doctors have been talking about treating diseases, whereas in fact it's always a patient they're treating. I've never treated a sore throat. I've treated a person with a sore throat. I treat a person with a cut finger, and that person happens to be a pianist. It's much more important than someone who is not a pianist. I think some of the doctors have been talking about treating diseases, whereas in fact they should be talking about treating a patient.
Dr. Bowman, do you agree with that? It's more about the patient, him or herself, as opposed to the disease?
It is, and I guess I'll carry that a little further to say sometimes we get into, well, you have to make sure you've treated blank, blank, and blank for the patient, but you've got to look at them as a whole, and what do they need, and what do they believe? Oftentimes, patient beliefs are extremely important to what can happen and who and what they are, and not just the patient, but their family. What is their context? What is the community they live in? What are they involved with at work? So it is about the patient, and sometimes I think we need to emphasize them feeling like they have met their outcomes more than what a health system or an insurance company says should be their outcome.
Herve, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
We're going to continue our discussion about medical students' training, and especially coming up, we're going to talk about the shortage of primary care physicians. If you have a question or a comment about that, we'd love to hear from you. 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. You can post on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We continue our discussion about the changes in how medical students are being trained and how the medical field is adapting to an aging population and a shortage of doctors, especially primary care physicians. Joining me are Chair and Fred Lazarus, Jr., Endowed Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Philip Diller, Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Chair of the Department of Medical Education at UC's College of Medicine, Dr. Andrew Filak, and joining us on the phone, Dean at the Wright State Boonshoff School of Medicine, Dr. Marjorie Bowman. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I should say, when I put this topic up on our Facebook page, this is the area that most people wanted to comment about, and we have a lot of questions and some phone calls already talking about this shortage of doctors. We're going to get to the phone calls in just a moment. Just very briefly, and Dr. Diller, we'll start with you. How great is this shortage of primary care physicians?
It's real. I mean, it is. I think the recent study that was done here in Cincinnati, the Greater Cincinnati Health Foundation put together, showed about a 200 to 250 physician shortage for primary care in a 9-county region. A big contributor is the anticipated increase in enrollment with the Accountable Care Act. I think we're projecting about 125,000 people in the greater Cincinnati area that would suddenly be enrolled. We don't have the physician manpower to do that, to take those patients.
Dr. Bowman?
I would add to the needs are not just the Accountable Care Act, which actually may be a small part of the increasing needs for physicians, but aging of the population enters in here, and the just growth of the population and the number of immigrants who join the United States as well. So in attempting to look at how many primary care physicians are needed, the Accountable Care Act is only a part of why we need more physicians than we have and why we need specifically more primary care physicians as well as geriatricians who are primary care for older patients.
Well, that's true, Marjorie. I agree with that.
We're getting a call now from Frank in Mainville. Hi, Frank. What's your question or comment?
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
The issue is this. There has to be a local as well as a national strategy to increase the number of primary care physicians for the nation. The data indicates that primary care physicians not only prevent more illness, but also reduce the cost of medical care. And I think this is a very major issue to our national well-being.
Excellent point. We agree.
Yes.
Dr. Phillip?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. You summed it up very nicely. A big problem that we have is a lack of a national workforce strategy, a lack of a prioritization. If you look at the data that Dr. Diller alluded to in the regional findings by the Health Collaborative that Dr. Robin Chapman had put together, those numbers probably even underestimate the process, because that is a body count of number of people with licenses. It doesn't talk about older people. It doesn't talk about people like myself. I am not in a full-time practice, but I am listed there. So I think that that's even an underestimate. And we don't have a strategy or a plan to address the problem, and that is of a real concern.
We have a Facebook question. I'm sorry, Frank, was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I just think it's something that has to be brought to light that is not being pursued by the federal government, state government, or local governments, as well as the profession itself, getting primary care physicians trained in the most efficacious way possible.
Thank you so much for your call.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We did get a question from Susan, who agrees that more primary care physicians are needed, but she talks about the outlying areas, semi-rural hospitals that are having a hard time recruiting. She's referring specifically to Dearborn County, Indiana, and areas east of Cincinnati. Do you find that the rural areas really are the greatest concern?
They are.
Yes.
We've had problems with distribution of physicians and where they're going to go. If you even look at our 9-county survey, Hamilton County has more primary care physicians per, say, 100,000 people. It's generally half than the number of docs that are needed out in those outlying communities, and that's true across the country. So distribution of primary care is a huge need, even more so than what we're going to experience here in the cities.
Dr. Bowman?
Yes. The rural areas are of major concern. We also have shortages, though, in poorer inner city areas. So we consider those the most underserved. We at Boonshoft have emphasized producing primary care physicians for particularly our surrounding areas. And it's still difficult for a school that emphasizes it and is always near the top in producing primary care physicians who practice to get enough people out into the rural environment.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can also send us a tweet at 917-WVXU or post on our Facebook page. Peter is calling from Montford Heights. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
What's your question?
I'm an internist in primary and private practice on the west side of town. I'm an old dinosaur. And I still use paper charts and take care of a lot of senior citizens on the western side of the county. My comment is, as an internist and primary care physician and as a volunteer educator at the College of Medicine, I have identified in part one reason for a primary care shortage in greater Cincinnati and across the nation that I believe to be greatly underestimated. And that is the fact that the students, they are encountering tremendous debt over the course of their medical education. And in primary care, in all truth, my colleagues will attest to this, I'm sure, primary care physicians are overwhelmingly underpaid for their efforts. We do a great job, I think, of taking care of very complex patients and take great pride in providing good care, but we are under-recognized with our importance in the role of taking care of the whole patient and are woefully underpaid, quite frankly.
Do you agree, Dr. Philek? Are PCPs underpaid?
Well, I'm going to address the other part of the question first, if that's mm-hmm. okay, and that has to do with the debt load, because I actually do think that is a major issue. It ties in with the reimbursement structure. Is in the College of Medicine, 80% of our class graduates more than $100,000 in debt, and 45% of our class is now graduating more than $200,000 in debt. And that is indeed a significant barrier for entering primary care relative to other specialties. So certainly on a relative level, primary care as compared to some of the specialties, there's a big income distance that is a problem and that discourages the applicants from going into primary care.
Dr. Diller?
No, it's true. There's good evidence that's come out of the literature as well that you look at the ratio of the mean salary for a primary care physician compared to the mean salary of a specialist. And there's a ratio, seems to be a number that's pretty significant. If the salary is 55% or less, family physician, say, makes 55% less than the specialist students, and this is true from like 1983 on, they've studied this, that students will not choose primary care as a specialty. You start to get above that and head towards 60%. You make 60% of what a specialist would make, students start to change their mind. It's interesting that it's that sensitive, but the data is there that students do pay attention to that, and it is a factor in their choice. And
Dr. Bowman?
I think that it's a combination of also prestige as well as income, and they're interrelated. The more income, the higher prestige. Canada, in fact, decided they needed more family docs and that they were struggling with this issue, and they increased the rate of pay of the family physicians substantially. I don't recall the exact amount, but I think it was like 70%, and dramatically changed things. So it's not that we don't have students who are interested in family medicine, but there are various things that deter their choosing it for the long run. They still make enough money that they can handle the debt and be in primary care. It's just the lifestyle that goes with that is not a lifestyle that is the same as the specialists, and it creates difficulties for us in helping to change the primary care shortage problem.
Peter, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just think the opportunity, but I try as an intern primary care physician to encourage my students to strongly consider a very rewarding career in primary care that I've experienced. But I do see those two as significant obstacles going forward for the foreseeable future.
Thank you so much for your call.
I'd like to thank the caller, because we need people like him who like what they do, will have students with them so the students can see just how pleasurable it can be to work with patients in family medicine and primary care.
Yes, thank you, Peter.
I agree with Dr. Bowman, and Peter is, as he stated, a volunteer, I don't know Peter personally, but a volunteer faculty member. He's donating his time to teach our medical students in addition to taking care of his patients. So thank you, Peter.
513-419-7100 is our number if you have a question or a comment today. Amal is on the phone from Evendale. Good afternoon, Amal.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to suggest that we have one of the greatest medical schools here in Cincinnati, and they receive a large number of applicants, and they turn down quite a few. And my question and my comment is, why can't we train more physicians? The shortage is not only for primary care, but in all subspecialties. Projections are we going to have major shortages?
Dr. Philek?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think over the past decade or so, there's been a significant push to increase the number of medical school graduates by 30%. And we've really accomplished that to some extent. that still isn't addressing the full physician shortage, because that has not led to an increase in the number of practicing physicians. The rate limiting step there is the number of residency positions. So 8 or 10 years ago, we had about 16,000 medical graduates per year and 21,000 residency slots. We now have close to 20,000 medical school graduates and maybe 22,000 residency positions available. What we have done is now we're not accepting as many international medical graduates into residency programs, and some of the U.S. graduates can't find a residency position. So the rate limiting step is not the medical school right now, it's the residency position level.
Dr. Bowman?
The residency positions are a big problem, and it is actually fearful for many medical schools and students about how this is going to proceed, because within a year or two, it looks like the number graduating from U.S. medical schools will be about the same as the number of residency slots available. That is a very tough situation to be in. The residency slots have been are a problem partially because the federal government pays for a large amount of residency positions, primarily through CMS, through Medicare, Medicaid. And those slots and the agreement by the federal government and Congress and the president to expand those has not happened. The hospitals could potentially self-fund them, but there is a fair amount of reluctance to do so, and an increasing one whenever they're financially stressed. So we have bills in Congress to try to improve or increase the number of residency slots and to increase the amount of federal funding. It's a tough time to talk about those things, but until that occurs, until there are more residency slots, it's going to be hard to have more physicians graduating and out there practicing.
Dr. Dillon?
I want to jump in on this just for local, you know, some of the issues around the pipeline issues in Southwest Ohio. Dayton, Ohio, where was one hospital, St. Elizabeth's, that actually closed in 2000. They had 12 family medicine residents in that hospital. Those residents are no longer being trained. So when you look back over that 13-year period, 12 less per year. Here in Cincinnati, the program that I know, the UC program with Christ Hospital, was actually reduced by 5 positions per year over the last decade. That's 50 family physicians who are no longer trained in that program. When you total up what was trained in Dayton and in Cincinnati over this decade, we trained 190 fewer physicians because of program closures or mergers or reductions.
Thank you so much for your call, Amal. We appreciate it. We now go to a call from Paul in Dayton. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Hi. Hi. Yes. I'm actually a third year med student, and this conversation really hit home. I'm actually driving home from my rotation, and it's just interesting this topic of us choosing specialty over primary care, because I think from the things that I hear from my colleagues and my fellow students about what influences our decision, it's definitely more about the debt, you know, so much debt that we get into after 4 years of med school, and you are like, you know, should you choose a specialty or going to primary care.
And we just have a couple of seconds left. Paul, what did you choose? Right. Are you going to go into a specialty, or are you going to become a primary care physician?
Well, right now, I'm kind of open-minded, but when it comes to eventual decision, it's going to be influenced by how much debt that I'm in and all that. But it's just a shame that there's a shortage, but, you know, there's very little incentive to kind of, like, help us be this huge debt deal.
Thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
I would note that I always recommend, as the student suggested, that students go into what is a fit, because in actual fact, over the years, although there's been a fairly consistent difference between primary care and specialties, within the specialties, which ones are
I've got to stop you right there. We're out of time. Thank you so much, okay. And thanks for joining us. We've been talking today with Chair and Fred Lazarus, Jr., Endowed Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Philip Diller, Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Chair of the Department of Medical Education at UC's College of Medicine, Dr. Andrew Filak. And joining us on the phone, Dean at the Wright State Boonshoff School of Medicine, Dr. Marjorie Bowman. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Thanks for listening.